Lecture 3. The Anti-Federalist Republican Vision.
In the last lecture, we saw how the Anti-Federalists make a qualified but still strong appeal to the classical Republican heritage. Qualified because the Anti-Federalists are by no means simply classical Republicans. They share, with the Federalists and with Americans generally, a Republican vision that is much less communal, much more individualistic and commercial than the classical ideal. Their highest priority, shared with the Federalists, is the protection of individual rights and liberties. But the Anti-Federalists contend that precisely in order to protect those individualistic rights and liberties, substantial ingredients of the old classical ideal in its Montesquieuian democratic reformulation remain essential. As the Pennsylvania writer, who calls himself a federal Republican, puts it, "Whatever the refinement of modern politics may inculcate, it still is certain that some degree of virtue must exist, or freedom cannot live." The Anti-Federalist position is vividly illustrated by what they say as regards religion. Anti-Federalists, as well as Federalists, are committed to individual religious freedom, and hence religious diversity. Yet, at the same time, the Anti-Federalists, like most Americans of the time, assume that the religious diversity would and should be a Christian, and even a mainly Protestant diversity. And what's more, they are convinced that Protestant Christian piety and religious education in the populace are essential foundations for civic virtue and citizenship education. Without widespread belief in a God who stands behind law-abiding justice, sanctioning morality with rewards and punishments in a life to come, too many people are tempted, they think, to neglect their demanding civic duties for the sake of pursuing their selfish material interests. In the Constitutional Convention itself, Benjamin Franklin, in a major speech on June 28th, had pleaded, unsuccessfully, for the convention to return to the prayerful piety that had helped inspire the Revolution. "I have lived," Franklin declared, "a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings, that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this," Franklin says, "and I also believe that without His concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. We shall be divided by our little partial local interests. Our projects will be confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and byword down to future ages. And what is worse, mankind may hereafter, from this unfortunate instance, despair of establishing governments by human wisdom and leave it to chance, war, and conquest." Now, the Anti-Federalists share Franklin's deep worry, and they warn that the proposed constitutional order will excessively diminish governmental support for this crucial role of Christian piety and religiously based virtue in civic life and education. And the Anti-Federalists point with dismay to the proposed constitution's stony silence on God and God's supreme authority, which is in striking contrast to the existing Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, which close with an acknowledgement of the ultimate political rule of God. And some of the Anti-Federalists are troubled by the proposed Constitution's outlawing of any religious test for holding office in Article 6, Section 3 of the Constitution. Thus, an Anti-Federalist who significantly signs himself with the biblical pen name Samuel protests that the President and Congress may consist, he says, of men of no principle, for no religion is required as any qualification to fill any and every seat. Moreover, one major reason why the Anti-Federalists argue that more power should be left to the states and localities is that they see state governments are better suited to provide government support through tax dollars for local Protestant sects. The sort of limited establishment of religion, rooted in local community sentiment that already existed at that time in many of the states, and that continued to exist well into the 19th century. These state establishments of religion were understood to go along with what the Maryland anti-federalist John Mercer terms local laws of morality, laws that, as he puts it, would prohibit the abuse of wealth and institute a council of censors to punish offenders. On the model, he says, of the small Swiss federal republics, above all Calvinist Geneva. But the concern for government support for religion and religiously based moral education is only one part of the reasons why the anti-federalists argue that the needed ingredients of the classical ideal will be better maintained by keeping the balance of power weighted more toward state and local government. Even more important, they argue, is the fact that at the state and local level, government is smaller in scale, hence less overbearing and domineering. By the same token, and still more important, government at the state and local level tends to involve the people more, to demand more from the people, thus keeping control in the people's hands, preventing and guarding against elite aristocratic tendencies. This popular participation in, and thus control over, the government is most widely activated through what Richard Henry Lee calls the people's just and rightful control in the judicial branch, that is, through their service on civil and criminal juries. And the anti-federalists warn that this proposed constitution is going to contribute to a grave weakening of the people's democratic control over the judicial branch of the government by instituting a drastic diminution of the power of popular juries in America, which will mutilate, they say, what is perhaps the most important institution for participatory democracy. Now, to understand what the anti-federalists are getting at in this warning, we must bear in mind an important historical fact about what the power of juries was in America at that time. Juries at the time of the founding had not only the right and power to determine matters of fact in the case before them, but also the right and power to interpret the meaning of the law. And this was a right and power rooted in classical republicanism, but not only there, but also in English tradition, celebrated by Montesquieu, who interpreted the British Constitution as placing the judicial branch in the hands of the people through the supreme power of the popular juries. And it was above all this power in the juries to participate in interpreting the law and even to overrule judges' interpretations of the law that made juries key democratic checks on aristocratic judicial activism. And anti-federalists, like the federal farmer, correctly predicted and foresaw that under the proposed Constitution, juries will lose the right to interpret the meaning of the law. Juries will be limited, they said, and they were right, to judging only the facts of the case before them. And as regards the more important power to interpret the law, the anti-federalists correctly warn, this basic, traditionally democratic power will be entirely handed over to the unelected judges, who will thus become a kind of aristocracy dominating the judicial branch. As John Mercer puts it, the jury, he says, is the democratic branch of the judiciary power, and as such is even more necessary than representatives in the legislature. Why, Mercer asks, shall we risk this important check to judiciary usurpation provided by the wisdom of antiquity? It's by the attacks on private property through the judiciary that despotism becomes as irresistible as terrible, he writes. And in addition, making things even worse in their view, the anti-federalists see that these aristocratic federal courts are given under this Constitution the right to overturn local democratic jury verdicts, meaning to say that jury verdicts will no longer be final. The anti-federalists point out that by Article 3, Section 2, Clause 2 of the proposed Constitution, the Supreme Court is given, quote, appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact. Now, it's of course not only the judicial branch of government that the Anti-Federalists see as best kept under local popular control. Equally important, they argue, is keeping the legislative branch under such control as much as possible. The Anti-Federalists argue that at the state level, elected representatives are more truly representative and responsive to the people's will, and for three major reasons, they argue. First, the state legislators meet at a place, the state capital, that is closer to the people and thus better observed by the people. Second, the state legislators tend to live more among the people and as a result are better known to the people in their personal lives and their character. And third, the state legislators tend to resemble or mirror better the people's own character. They tend less to be an elite that lives a lifestyle unlike that of the people. And here, the Anti-Federalists, in effect, articulate a specific theory of what genuinely democratic representation ought to mean. Melancton Smith, the leading Anti-Federalist speaker and debate opponent of Hamilton in the New York Convention, puts it this way. The idea that naturally suggests itself to our minds when we speak of representatives is that they resemble those they represent. They should be a true picture of the people and sympathize in all their distresses. Or in the words of Samuel Chase, who had been a leader of the Revolution in Maryland, a representative should be the image of those he represents. He should know their sentiments and their wants and their desires. He should possess their feelings. He should be governed by their interests, with which his own should be inseparably connected. And, the Anti-Federalists add, it's only such representatives, whom the people truly know as kindred spirits, that the people will readily obey and follow with trust. As Brutus says, the confidence which the people have in their rulers in a free republic arises from their knowing them. No one expressed the critical bite of the Anti-Federalist theory of representation better than an unknown Massachusetts writer who signed himself Cornelius. He put it this way, the members of our state legislature, he pointed out, are annually elected. They are subject to instructions. They are chosen within small circles. They are sent but a small distance from their respective homes. They frequently see and are seen by the men whose servants they are. They return and mix with their neighbors of the lowest rank, see their poverty, and feel their wants. On the contrary, the members of the proposed Congress are to be chosen for a term of years. They're to be subject to no instructions. They're to be chosen within large circles. They'll be unknown to a considerable part of their constituents, and their constituents will be not less unknown to them. They will be far removed and long detained from the view of their constituents. Their general conduct will be unknown. Their chief connections will be with men of the first rank in the United States, who've been bred in affluence at least, if not in the excess of luxury. Let anyone judge, he says, whether they will long retain the same ideas as their constituents. And finally, the Anti-Federalists also argue that if the power is kept more at the state and local level, then there's more likelihood of the elected representatives coming from the agrarian middle-class farmers, yeomen, as they put it, or small farmers who own their own land, who cannot easily afford to stand for office if they have to travel far away from their farms to serve for long periods in some distant national capital, but who are more likely to be able to serve if the seat of government is closer by and the meetings shorter or frequently interrupted. And having representatives who are yeomen tends to keep leaders, as well as the populace, less luxurious, more moderate in their love of money and in their wealth, making the leadership less tempted to luxurious greed and ambition, and making the populace less likely to divide into hostile classes, separated by vast disparities of wealth and economic interest, thus preserving more of that classical homogeneity and similarity of lifestyle that's needed for fraternal and communal spirit. Where, as the writer who signs himself Cato says in his third letter, acquaintance, habits, and fortunes nourish affection and attachment. Or as Brutus says in his first essay, in a republic, the manners, sentiments, and interests of the people should be similar. If this be not the case, there'll be a constant clashing of opinions, and the representatives of one part will be continually striving against those of another. Echoing a major thesis of Aristotle's Politics, Melancthon Smith, in debating Alexander Hamilton in the New York Ratifying Convention, said, those in middling circumstances have less temptation. They're inclined by habit and the company with whom they associate to set bounds to their passions and appetites. If this is not sufficient, the want of means to gratify them will be a restraint. They're obliged to employ their time in their respective callings. Hence, the substantial yeomanry of the country are more temperate, of better morals, and less ambition than the great. The latter do not feel for the poor and middling class. A representative body, composed principally of respectable yeomanry, is the best possible security to liberty. The interests of both the rich and the poor are involved in that of the middling class. No burden can be laid on the poor but what will sensibly affect the middling class. And any law rendering property insecure would be injurious to the rich. When therefore this yeoman class in society pursue their own interest, they promote that of the public, for it is involved in it. But in addition to promoting moderate wealth and similarity and fellow feeling, the leadership of yeoman farmers at the state and local level will bring yet another great civic good, the Anti-Federalists argue. It will tend to instill throughout society the healthy influence of people who are more economically self-sufficient and thus more independent in spirit. No one expressed this thought more eloquently than Thomas Jefferson, who characterized himself in a famous letter as neither Federalist nor Anti-Federalist, who, in other words, saw himself as straddling the great debate and seeing wisdom in both sides. Jefferson's most important and somewhat classical-sounding pronouncement on the moral superiority of putting power in local government dominated by the small farmers is found in the one book he ever published, Notes on the State of Virginia, which was published in the same year as the Federalist and during the constitutional debates. There Jefferson says, in a famous passage, those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God, if ever he had a chosen people, whose breasts he has made his peculiar deposit for substantial and genuine virtue. It is the focus in which he keeps alive that sacred fire which otherwise might escape from the face of the earth. Corruption of morals in the mass of cultivators is a phenomenon of which no age nor nation has furnished an example. It is the mark set on those who, not looking up to heaven, to their own soil and industry, as does the husbandman, which is a term Jefferson uses for the farmer, for their subsistence, depend for it on the casualties and caprice of customers. Dependence begets subservience and venality, suffocates the germ of virtue, and prepares fit tools for the designs of ambition. This, the natural progress and consequence of the arts, has sometimes perhaps been retarded by accidental circumstances, but, generally speaking, the proportion which the aggregate of the other classes of citizens bears in any state to that of its husbandmen is the proportion of its unsound to its healthy parts, and is a good enough barometer whereby to measure its degree of corruption. While we have land to labor, then, let us never wish to see our citizens occupied at a workbench. Let our workshops remain in Europe. It is better to carry provisions and materials to workmen there than bring them to the provisions and materials, and with them, their manners and principles. The loss by the transportation of commodities across the Atlantic will be made up in happiness and permanence of government. The mobs of great cities add just so much to the support of pure government as sores do to the strength of the human body. It is the manners and spirit of a people which preserve a republic in vigor. A degeneracy in these is a canker which soon eats to the heart of its laws and constitution. Now, at this point, with the anti-federalist critique laid out, it's time for us to turn to consider the arguments and grounds upon which the Federalist Papers take their stand in response. And to begin with, what we see as we open the Federalist and read on through the first few papers is that their rhetorical strategy is not one of defense, but rather of offense, of counterattack on a new flank. They launch their counterattack by an initial shift of focus, change of subject. The Federalist Papers begin not by taking up and responding to the challenge laid down by the Anti-Federalists as to how Republican liberty is to be maintained in domestic civil life. Instead, Publius switches the subject to national security, switches the spotlight to the necessities of national defense and foreign policy, and argues that these are the necessities that most obviously require a much more consolidated and powerful central government. And if we look at the actual text of the Constitution itself, and we see that of the 18 enumerated powers given to the national legislature in Article 1, Section 8, fully half of those pertain to defense and foreign affairs. The argument on this basis of national security starts with John Jay pointing out in the third paper that in order not to give other nations plausibly just causes for conflict with America, the country as a whole and all its citizens must faithfully observe international law and custom, and especially all sworn treaty obligations. And such fidelity is much more likely, he argues, with a unified central government that can authoritatively and reliably control all foreign relations and exercise its authority directly on individual citizens as well as on state and local governments. Doing so not only, he argues, through a powerful legislature and executive, but also through a national judiciary whose interpretations of law in relation to foreigners are final and binding on everyone. In the absence of such a strong centralized government, Jay argues, the different states and even individuals in each state are all too likely, as is happening right now, Jay says, to be tempted by their immediate and local interests to vary widely and provocatively in the way they interpret and abide by international obligations, and are all too likely to drag the whole rest of the nation into wars over what are essentially local quarrels inflamed by local passions in regard to Indian tribes as well as bordering European empires. Besides, Jay argues, a strong central government will tend to draw to it leaders who are more prudent and far-sighted as regards foreign affairs. Leaders who will, by the great responsibilities of their national offices, tend to have a broader and less parochial regard for the overall interests of the whole country. And in addition, will be able to negotiate with foreign powers from a position of greater strength and hence advantage. What's more, Jay goes on to argue in the fourth paper, a strong central government will deter foreign powers from being tempted to take advantage of the weakness, disunity, and fractiousness of a looser confederacy. And there will be plenty of occasions for such temptations, Jay warns. And later, Hamilton warns about this danger of fractiousness even more emphatically, especially in papers 11 and 24. America's seafaring commerce already, Hamilton says, excites great rivalry from European commercial powers who would like, Hamilton says in his words, to clip the wings on which we might soar to a dangerous greatness. And European manufacturing powers will want access to, and if possible, dominance over the growing consumer market within America, Hamilton warns. And the Spanish and British empires surround America and dominate the West Indies. Now, Jay and Hamilton argue, if we are going to effectively deter these great European commercial empires from exercising domination through intimidation over us, then we must put power in this central government to raise and maintain unified naval and land forces of whatever size may be judged necessary. And this military power in the central government must include the ability to organize and regulate and employ the state militias, and as Jay puts it, in a manner, consolidate them into one corps, referring to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16 of the Constitution, which indicates just that. But this power must also include, Jay argues, the authority to maintain a standing professional national army as well as a navy in peacetime. Now, as Hamilton makes much clearer in the subsequent papers 12 and later, especially papers 30 through 36, the central government cannot have these powers without having also what he calls the unlimited power of taxation, which is necessary to raise the revenues upon which a powerful military defense can be built. And we notice that the very first of the enumerated powers given to the national legislature under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution is the taxation power. The Constitution views the taxation power as the primary power of government. In this opening argument, Jay and Hamilton have in effect elaborated the standard set by the exigencies of foreign affairs and national security, by which, they contend, one must judge the adequacy of the powers of any government for America. And by this standard, Hamilton proceeds in the papers starting with number 15, to judge as grossly inadequate the existing Articles of Confederation. And more importantly, and more generally, he and then Madison go on to argue that on this basis, on the basis of the needs of national security, there is a decisive inadequacy in any and all Confederate systems throughout all past history. All Confederacies, such as are envisioned as ideal by the Anti-Federalists, they argue, have been disasters from the point of view of national security and foreign and defense policy. In the next lecture, we'll follow the elaboration of this critique of Confederation on the basis primarily of the needs of national security, and then we'll look to see how the Anti-Federalists respond, or what is their conception of the needs of foreign policy and defense.